Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is writer and director Nick McNulty. He directed the 2016 found footage film Capture Kill Release, which you've heard me talk about before on the podcast. And his debut novel, Skinning the Coyote, is out now from Wicked House Publishing. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Hey. To chat with you. And so can we, let's start with your novel. Can you tell our listeners a little bit of, about it?
My novel, Skinning the Coyote, is, I've pitched it as dad lit. It's very much the a cottage read, you know, something in the 80s or 70s when you could smoke on an airplane, you'd find a dog-eared copy at the airport and read. And it's a real mashup love letter to two of my favorite genres, to Westerns and horror, and playing them both really straight, you know, not ironically. You know, I love Westerns, love horror, and put these two things into a blender. You know, really takes a page out of the book from something like From Dusk Till Dawn, where it's going along one story that the audience is fully in for the ride for until things get flipped on its head. So this is you know, a plot similar to something like 310 to Yuma, where it's got some good guys and bad guys racing to a town to go and hang an outlaw, and when they all get there and they're ready for a showdown with one another, they everything gets flipped on its head, and they get into this battle with this supernatural beast, and they all have to, you know, put their differences aside and form this uneasy alliance where nobody really trusts each other to try to figure out what the hell this thing is and how to take it out.
Okay.
Yeah, I love that. So how did the idea for Skinning the Coyote come about for you?
For me, it's like my background is movies, it's cinema first. So this is my first step into the novel world. So this actually started as a script before it was something that just wasn't really feasible. It was just a little bit too big, too ambitious. You know, the genre flip is something that's a little bit riskier, and started as that. And I wanted to make something that the real inspiration for this is Predator. I love Predator.
Okay.
Predator is one of my favorite movies. And I think what makes Predator work, that a lot of the sequels and just handling of the franchise for a long time, it's kind of course corrected now with something like Prey, but why that first movie works so well, and same with the Aliens, the second Aliens movie, which the sequels kind of lost, is it sets up these really badass macho marine style characters that see, you know, they're these Green Berets, they're Marines, they're taking out a whole army, you know, giving off one-liners, no problem. You've got the biggest action stars in the world playing them, and then suddenly this thing that you can't explain comes and it just mops the floor with them. And, you know, you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is the action star, still is the action star if you're going to stack them up. And he's like the last survivor fighting in the muck against this thing. You know, and sequels went on where it's, you know, I think at one point they're like, maybe one of the Aliens versus Predators, the humans are just kind of cannon fodder instead of like this,
just
what
there
should be this real threat to this. So, you know, I saw another movie that kind of did that right, that wasn't an Aliens or a Predator sequel, was Dog Soldiers, where it's like, again, we set up these awesome Scottish soldiers are on like a training mission or something, and then it becomes a werewolf movie and you're like, what am I watching? This is so cool. So I wanted to make something like that, but with Western. It was just, the pitch was like Predator but a Western. So set up a great Western with tough guys, tough good guys, tough bad guys, have them have their own conflict. And then without calling it a Predator, because this is not the Predator, but inspired by that, of setting them up against something out of this world, unholy and essentially unbeatable, and see what happens. So that's the real draw and kind of inspiration for where this story came from.
Oh, yeah. Would you ever make it into a movie? Would you adapt it into a movie if the opportunity ever arose?
In a heartbeat.
Hell yeah. If okay, that cool.
came. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's there was a script first. It's in my mind. and then it was like, okay, how do I make this something else? But absolutely.
Well, it is very cinematic though, the way you write. And so it's interesting because especially it hit me with the cold open with how you're shifting perspectives in a really interesting way by going I like how you shift perspectives and it feels like, oh, we're changing scenes almost. And I like how, again, it feels like you're reading. It feels very cinematic in the experience. And so I think it would be such a good movie. And I love when movies take a huge turn, like a huge plot turn like that and become something else.
I love it when, if a cool. movie does that, I'm like, I'm in. And it can shift it can shift genres. It can be like last one I think that did it where I'm like, oh my God, I love you. Barbarian.
I was literally thinking Barbarian when you were saying that.
I'm like, just keep doing this every movie ever. Just keep giving me this because it's a life energy. I love it so much.
Me too. I am curious since you have been in the film world and you've written scripts, how hard was it to adapt into writing a novel? Because the script and the novel have a lot of differences between them.
It was... In some ways, I don't want to say very easy, but easier than I would imagine what it's like. And in a lot of ways, like extremely, extremely difficult. When it comes to writing and directing a film, like it's got to be on the page, but there's so many pieces that come together to make that happen. And in probably the most pretentious way I can say this, the director is almost like the maestro that's working with a army of extremely talented people, and they've got to be able to hone everybody's skills and bring it together. But you've got that ensemble of work that if they can orchestrate that, you've got it. You've got magic as long as it was on the page. When it's a novel, you strip all that away, and the sole author has to put that on the page. And if it's not working, then it's not working. You don't have that other talent to bring in to do that. So that's really difficult. The writing style's extremely, extremely different. It's a little bit more naked because you're seeing all the words on the page versus what may or may not be there in another capacity. I think when writing a script, I don't want to say your writing doesn't have to be as strong, because I don't mean that from a storytelling perspective, but you can... I generally tend to be a little bit more of an efficient writer when it comes to, X happens, so-and-so goes to the door. Like, it doesn't have to be so, so flowery necessarily.
Right.
You want to have a lot of white on the page and efficiencies and things happening. So this here, you're filling the page with words, but you also don't want it to just be clunky and filled with words for word's sake. So that makes it very difficult. On the other hand, and again, this is coming from somebody, the first time novelist versus somebody who this is what they do. I don't know what their process is like, but here I had a bit of a Coles note cheat sheet. I think anybody of a certain generation like loved the novelization of their favorite movies in a way it's like I got to go and make this. So it's, some things change, characters change. A lot of it was expanded. There's different perspectives that are seen, but in terms of who these characters are, what the beats are for the story, generally what's going to happen to get from point A to B to C was all there. And that writing and work did have to go into it first, but, that being done, did ease a lot of the where am I going. It didn't feel aimless during any of the process.
That's awesome. And would you ever write another novel then? I mean, obviously film is your first love, but would you try a novel? another novel?
I definitely would. It's not, it's a lot. It's a lot. Like my hat off to everybody that just attempts to do it once. Like, yeah. Great, good on you, because it is a hell of a lot of work. And I see people just putting out so much work. Like, it's incredible. For me, yes, I would like to, but like at the capacity that some authors are able to do, no way. And you know, I've got a lot of ideas that would like to put to screen, and you know, most of those probably won't make it there for a variety of different reasons. So it's if the right one of those, there's a few that there's one at least where I'm like, oh, that is an idea, but it's I don't know how, I don't know if I will, but I would definitely do it in theory.
Hell yeah. And so do you want to pick your brain briefly about Capture, Kill, Release, which I've talked about before, and I love it. It is one of my favorite found footage movies. It's weird and gross and has a fucked up woman in it, and there's like weird sex on screen, which we don't really get in found footage a lot. And I just like how you subvert a lot of the gendered tropes we see, not just in horror, but in found footage in particular. And I just like wanted to hear more about working on that movie. And like, I know that I had previously interviewed you and asked you similar questions, but I just want to hear more about like tapping into the found footage subgenre to create this really cool little piece of found footage that I love very much.
Yeah. Do you just want to generally dive in, or anything you want to know? AMA on Capture, Kill, Release.
Okay. Well, I guess my big thing was like, I want to ask about like including like the sex scene in the movie, because I know that's like very specific, but again, in found footage, like we never really have, it's usually guys being creepy and like hiding the camera and being weird to women. But here she's like, fuck yeah, let's record us having sex. And I love that. Like there's agency in it in a way that we don't ever see in found footage for some reason. And it just is really cool to see that. You know what I mean?
It's funny because, you know, talking about how unique that perspective seems, but to me that seems so strange. Like the amount of people that are filming themselves having sex is just everybody, like it just is. You've got it. Like it's the biggest cliche of just everybody at some point in some relationship is like experimenting with like, oh, what if we filmed ourselves and put it on there? And you know, it's something that's it's so vulnerable. I was going to say it's so naked. It's literally naked. You know, it's this vulnerable private thing. And you know, when found footage is done right, it's really just, it's tapping into this realism and in this, am I seeing something I'm not supposed to see, which this movie really has a lot of. So it, you know, and there's a lot of just sexual energy in what they're doing, both said and unsaid, that it really makes sense that it should be there. And I want to claim like, oh, I was trying to break this by putting something in there that's not seen in movies, but it really seems like something that you know, and in all ways, like, you know, you're saying there's a creepy guy with the camera, I'm surprised there's not more creepy sex in found footage movies, more sensual sex in found footage, more like found footage of found footage, because it is like this found thing that what we're not supposed to see. You know, we're seeing a lot more violence in there, which is less seen on that, but I think the amount of people that are filming themselves having sex and profiting off it and not profiting off it and keeping it private and stuff leaking, like it's where we are as a society. So
you just have to go to Pornhub and you will see thousands of people that decide to film themselves. Like it's just a part of our culture now.
There's so much in the genre that could pull on and stories that can be told. It doesn't even have to be traditional horror. The idea of something like that being out there and found, like it's a lot. It's a very intimate thing that people still have this like fascination to get on film, and that idea of it getting out to the world is so scary that this genre tapping into a lot of that, of like, it is found footage. It's not, I've made this for somebody to see. It just it makes perfect sense to me.
Well, and again, I think there's an issue and this is like a whole other discussion about like people being okay with violence but not with sex, and like not understanding like how you can link horror and sex in really sexy ways, not just like sex is bad ways. And I love seeing that in movies, because, and I think there's more of that happening, but I love a good horny found footage movie or a horny horror movie, and it's just great. I love horny horror. So that's who I am, I guess.
I'm glad we delivered. There is a lot out there, like you said. It's out there, and a lot of it's out there, like, I want to say explicitly, like, here's what we're really saying, and people are just missing the point, but it's there.
It's there. Well, so I would love to hear about how you got introduced to horror. Like, how did horror come into your life?
I don't think there was too much of that, like, this is the moment. I think like there's a couple things that it's one, I think all kids, no matter what, to a certain degree, they like to be scared. We as people like to be scared. You know, why do we like a roller coaster? You know, we like to be scared in a safe way, and kids really like it. I'm actually a big, there's a lot less of it now, but there used to be a lot more horror aimed at kids because it's something that they just like. And, you know, I'm maybe pulling this out of my ass, but maybe, you know, kids, if you're born of a certain generation, there's probably more horror fans because we just grew up that had this like awesome catalog of horror for kids, but it wasn't pandering. It was like still scary. The scares are real, and I don't want to say it's doesn't exist now, but it's not there. And kids like to be scared. They like to put their toe right up to the line. They like the thing, thinking like they like to show how brave they are, and then they're gonna have the nightmare later. But it's cool. It's important. So like, you know, that's not unique to me. I just like always loved it. I have two older sisters, so it's like anything they watched, I would just watch. I'd have to like, you know, whether one of them was watching me or just like me wanting to like be included. But you know, they would watch things that were probably like a couple years ahead, and I would just like have to see it. And then of that same generation, like obsessed with the horror movie section in the video store.
That's me.
Yeah.
Like, those grimy VHS covers like that are cut and put in the clamshell cases that are all dirty, and like you can't rent, but it's like when you're going to find a movie, you kind of sneak there, you gotta look at all of them, you know, you see a shish kebab going in a guy's mouth, like
yes,
you know, and you swear like
looking at the covers,
and you swear like I'm gonna watch every one of these movies someday, and 99% of them didn't live up to like the version
not even
of the movie
remotely
you made up. You know, so yeah. It's like you probably would have been better watching off the movie as a kid and being like, oh, it's not so bad, versus like what some of those covers were as a kid. So like loved that stuff, and just stuck with it. Maybe some people like they're scared and they run away and they don't do it so much, but like love it. And loved it then, and just stuck with it even when it scared me, because I think when it scares you, that's what makes it the best.
Yeah. How much older or what's the age difference between you and your sisters?
They're 2 and 4 years ahead.
Okay.
But cool. We had kind of, I could say it, the statute of limitations has passed, like a black cable box at our family. So it's just like whatever movie was on, like just watched it.
Yep.
You know, my parents were shift work, so it was kind of like if my mom was gone, then it's like what my dad wanted to watch is also what we were watching. So you know, it was a time when they made a RoboCop cartoon. You know, it's called it's called, you know, and we somehow all watched it, and then watching with adult eyes, like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's amazing because I grew up in like the 80s. And so like all the kind of stuff that would come out that were adaptations of something that was for adults or like for older kids and is now like being presented for young kids was all over the place. Like everything
from
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes to like
there was a fucking Toxic Avenger cartoon.
There was a Toxic Avenger cartoon.
There was a Toxic Avenger cartoon. Holy shit, I forgot about that.
The Toxic Crusaders.
That's right. Yep.
But yeah, it was like when I saw that movie, still saw that movie too young, loved it as a kid that shouldn't have been watching it. But I'm like, this is the movie that the cartoon was based on. There's RoboCop, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. There, when Terminator 2 came out, there were toys for that, army of toys.
Oh yeah,
that
I remember collecting Terminator. Go ahead. I was just gonna say I had collected a bunch of the Alien toys. Like they made a bunch of like Aliens toys in like the early 90s, I want to say, and it's like they're advertising rated R movie Ripley Aliens Death Destruction to young kids.
It was the Aliens cartoon was my, or sorry, the Aliens toys were the introduction to Aliens for me.
Okay.
I had a friend that his dad just let him watch whatever he, so he came, he's like, oh, there's aliens. I'm like, what are these, you know? And like that, I'm like, now I've got to watch this this movie, and like became obsessed with it. But yeah, Aliens, actually the Aliens toys, I read something recently that because they like the designs of them all looked really different. I guess they tried to get like a comic book going it was going to be a Saturday morning cartoon based on Aliens. And like just because of likeness reasons, they changed the way they looked. So because of this, they made these badass toys. And then last minute, I think somebody got cold feet or it didn't work. Cartoon got yanked, but they had these toys in production. And that's how we got those wicked Kenner Aliens toys.
That's so wild to me.
Whoa.
Like, what a time to be alive in that, if for to be a kid in that time. I honestly think the best toys were in the 80s and early 90s.
There would be a toy for everything. There'd be a cartoon, maybe there'd be a video game. You know, probably not very good, but you want a Total Recall video game? You got it.
Nightmare on Elm Street video game, a Jason video game. I was playing those as a kid. I was playing those.
I'm a big fan of the Jason video game. I know it's got a bad reputation, but it's like there's some good early survival horror going on there. Creepy ass score and you want to talk horror? There's a game over. Do you remember what the game over screen for this is?
No, I don't.
So you die and it's like you get this like an 8-bit sound of like the Jason sound, goes quiet. And then it types out, you and your friends are dead.
That's right.
And reading that is like, that's like too real.
That's a lot for a kid. That is a lot.
That's a lot. Whoa. That's a lot for me. I carry that weight with me now. I'm like, shit, should I play that game? I don't want to hear that me and my friends are dead.
I had never beat that game. I would always get murdered by Jason, and it became like a frustrating thing for me. So I never finished it, and I stopped playing it. But yes, now that you are mentioning it, I do remember that text.
Ugh. You and your friends. Yeah, it goes quiet. It's over black. I think you hear the text typing out, and it's just like it's unsettling.
Well, do you remember the first horror movie you ever saw?
So I don't know if this is the first, but and we talked about this before, but something that like just really stuck with me. My sisters loved Little Shop of Horrors. And for me, when I was like a little kid, there's something about, I don't know why, but anything with like sharp teeth, that was it. It's like I can't handle anything with sharp teeth. You know, if a dinosaur had like filed down teeth, that's fine. But if a dinosaur has like a mouthful of like razor sharp teeth, absolutely scared the shit out of me. I can't see this. And Audrey too, that incredible puppet, had like rows and rows and rows of sharp teeth. This movie is just, it's got great music, a murderer's row of comedians. You know, so my sisters are enjoying it for this reason, and like I can't grasp that this is a comedy, but still weirdly drawn to it. Like, when's that plant gonna come? And then whenever that plant did come, and just this beautiful puppetry full of teeth, just scared the shit out of me. So that's probably like one of the earliest memories of like something horrific going on there.
Okay.
And then probably, you know, we're talking kids horror movies that really stuck. And, you know, we're going to the 80s where it's like What Flew as Kids was a little bit looser then, but Monster Squad for me struck a chord. To this day, I'm like, forget Goonies, it's Monster Squad all the way. And that was kind of my, like, this is this safe zone of horror, which you could just watch like again and again, and loved it. Loved it.
Were you scared easily as a kid?
I had a lot of empathy of things that would happen in movies. There was like the sharp teeth thing when I was like much smaller, which is like a no. And then when I got over that to a degree, it was like, I could watch it, get scared, and it's fine. But then when something like really real happened, and it was always like Littlefoot's mother dying in Land Before Time, that's the start of the movie. And I'm, people talk about Bambi's mother, but that's like not a thing. I think that's overhyped. A deer gets shot, but this is like, she's dying. She tells him life lessons, and you're like, couldn't handle that. That broke me.
It's funny because that broke me, and then also the Dumbo scene where the mom is in her, like, and she is cradling her baby with her trunk,
like, that
broke me. Stop. Like, fuck Bambi. These are the two things that scarred me as a kid.
And these are the horrors. Yeah, because before that, like Dumbo's mother has this like rampage, and it's a pretty scary scene. And it's like that to me, like stuff with even as a small kid, I could see like kids and their mothers and losing them. Like that was unlocking a level of horror. Just forget the monsters. The monsters were fun to like toe up to, but I could still tell that was not real. And then even though this is a cartoon talking dinosaur, when the cartoon talking dinosaur is dying and talking to her cartoon dinosaur son, that just like bawling and can't handle that. And then I brought up Turner and Hooch, whoever's decision it was to shoot a dog at the end. Like it's always bad to shoot the dog, but like the whole concept of the movie, it lives and dies on like, what if dog was funny? What if dog drooled on Tom Hanks? And then we're going to shoot it. And I think my dad regretted renting that because he's trying to calm me down at the end, like, oh look, there's puppies, because like that's the reveal. And I knew, it's like, doesn't matter, Hooch is dead, man.
They really like to fuck with kids
this is what we've unlocked. This is why that generation's so into horror. It's not because of the horror movies we had, it's because the kids movies and night, it's just like, fuck it, we're gonna go there.
Yeah,
I was on TikTok the other day, as I am wont to do, and there was a video, and I grew up in the 90s, and it was like, this is what your like non-Disney princess movie says about you. And my favorite non-Disney princess movie / my favorite Disney movie is Anastasia, which is the tale of Anastasia Romanov and how she escaped the hands of Rasputin. Didn't think about how that movie, have either of you seen Anastasia, the animated Anastasia?
Yes.
Didn't really until like 2 days ago put together that movie is essentially a horror movie, and it's all body horror with Rasputin, and that was my favorite movie as a child. And that really kind of explained so much about who I am now. And I wanted to be Anastasia and fight Rasputin and like pull him apart. So like
amazing. Don Bluth, man, he knew. Another movie I was thinking about for this was All Dogs Go to Heaven, because like, Jesus Christ,
it fucked me up as a kid, but I loved it.
He got it. He's like, kids can handle it.
Kids are smart. I think that's
also striking. maybe we can't, because we're like all unpacking this. decades later.
If he wasn't traumatizing you, he was making you lust after anamorphic creatures like Justin the Rat, mm-hmm, or Robin Hood or Maid Marian, depending on your interest. Like that is it. It's so funny to me that he was tapping into both like horrific things that would not talk down to kids, but then also making incredibly sexy animals, and it's so weird to me.
Don Bluth, a pioneer in horny horror.
There you go.
Thank
Started
you,
there.
Don Bluth. did he also have The Great Mouse Detective?
You know what? I'm not sure. That one is another.
Have you seen The Great Mouse Detective, Nick?
I have not.
So it's like, it's Sherlock Holmes was mice.
It wasn't.
And it wasn't. Okay. It's a Disney movie, but it there's a burlesque dancing scene with a mouse who has huge tits and is in like doing like a strip tease. And it's with a children's animated movie.
The kicks and everything.
It's my favorite because it is the most inappropriate thing I've ever seen. And it's fully animated in a children's Disney movie. And she's like singing about being like.
As soon as we're done, I'm looking this up.
Oh, I'll email it to you. Oh, but so are you getting away from attractive animated creatures as we
which we can keep talking about if you want.
No, I mean, it's okay. We can. We
go down that rabbit hole.
Go down that route. Do you still get scared watching horror movies now as an adult, or are you more jaded?
I don't want to say jaded. But it's rare to scare me. It's like, I love the ride. And I probably love the ride more than something that does scare me. Not to say, if something scares me, it's really that it's like, it's got to be super unnerving, which I love. I love when a movie can do that. It's a lot more rare, but that's when it does do that. It's not necessarily a fun thing that I want to like keep returning to. So, you know, coming back to something like Barbarian, it's got the twists and turns and like that, but it was fun. It's fun. It's a fun ride, even though there's some like pretty dark themes in there. Like I would watch this again. If it unnerves me, then I don't want to say jaded because like, I love it. I love both versions, but it's probably what I want to watch less of, you know. It's and movies still do it. They'll get under your skin.
Do you remember the last movie that unnerved you?
A few, like I want to say recent, but some of them are like 10 years old now. Like I think Sinister did a really good job with just like kind of it where it was kind of like really pulling where that was going. It all felt very earned. The you know, really kind of famous, the end of The Strangers and what does like that for sure. Martyrs, which Martyrs is a nice rare case of it's really unnerving, but when coming back to what we're talking about switching genres, I knew like not, I'm like, what am I watching? Is this a supernatural movie? Is it this or that? A movie I would like, not as a whole, but you know, there were bits of not traditional horror, but Parasite, I thought was like, it's starting to get in some bits. I'm like, holy shit. Like, do I want to turn this off when it's like, when things sort of flip and, you know, talk about a movie that's doing so much with genres. So it's there, they're there. It's, you know, sometimes it's like, it's too much for me. I don't think I've finished the, like after like six attempts, I've never finished Gummo. Like that's just too.
Oh, I've
never seen Gummo.
I haven't tried it yet. I'm nervous. These movies make me nervous.
It makes like, and that's next level. I think
that's like transgressive to like the extreme. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's like a few in there where I'm like, okay, you have achieved this that I cannot finish. I haven't finished Inland Empire. I'm just like, I can't.
I haven't tried that one yet either.
And even the bits I watch, I'm like, this is good, but it's like, I'm a big Lynch fan. And that's like, he's pushed this to another level. So it's like horror can be so many things. I could be scared. I could be unnerved, but generally a lot of times when I'm kind of talking about what I'm into, it's probably that ride that we're chasing.
Yeah. Cool.
I get that.
All right, Nick. Well, we've talked about your horror history and your creative works, but what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
I brought with me a banger of a movie, just brilliant, brilliant piece of cinema. Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Ah, yes. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So in the film, when eccentric man-child Pee-wee Herman gets his beloved bike stolen in broad daylight, he sets out across the U.S. on the adventure of his life.
Yes. All right. So I have not watched this movie in a very, 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 very long time, since I was a kid. And I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I am curious. Take us back to the beginning. How old were you when you saw this? How did you see this? Why is this one of your Scarred for Life picks?
I saw this movie, I was probably like 4 years old. When I was a kid, my grandfather had like every movie imaginable, and he had, for some reason, he had them all on beta. He had a VCR and a beta, and he would just
rent. I grew up with a beta.
Absolutely. But they were all pirated beta movies.
Yep,
he would rent movies from Jumbo Video or wherever. He'd tape them just like without seeing them. And then we'd go to visit him, and it would just be like better than the video store. You wouldn't, because they're all just like handwritten labels, like three movies on each beta tape. And that's it. So it would just be like, you would kind of just watch everything, you know, to get through the tapes. And then it's like, you get, again, having older sisters, they know who Pee-wee is, into this movie, and it got a lot of play. And yeah, I mean, this movie is a lot. Like, Pee-wee in general is just a lot. There's some, like, on paper, I don't know how it worked, that 1980s cocaine just must have been as good as everybody said, because there's something that shouldn't work on paper. I couldn't pitch it to you if you gave me $10 million and make it make sense. But this mad genius came along with this idea, and he sold it to the world, and it was not small. It was not like, oh, there's this weird little movie you've got. Like, Pee-wee was a cultural phenomenon. It was like, I think he started it as a stage show, and then that just ballooned into, I think the movie came before the show, and this movie
did,
is just,
but
like,
he did have an HBO show that was like more geared towards adults a little bit, like it was like, and so he had that, and then that is what got him this movie. And then it became like a kid's show. But like, the original thing was, he tried out for Saturday Night Live. He didn't get it because Gilbert Godfrey got it over him. And so then
only
he was thinking,
only one freak allowed on SNL at a time. Right? Only one freak allowed.
And then he did this hour long, I think it was called the Pee Wee Herman Show, I think is what the original thing was called. And it was a little bit more like, we're not talking like adult humor, but like, we're talking about, it was like more of a nostalgia thing for adults that grew up in from the 50s and seeing like a Howdy Doody show or whatever they grew up on in the 50s. Mm-hmm. It was like the intent behind it. And then they got this movie.
Yeah. And it's like, it's all brilliant and madness. And why does this work? Does it work? Is this my nostalgia? Is it like, what do blind eyes coming to see Pee Wee Herman think of what that is? And I don't even know where to start, because there is just so much with everything Pee Wee, and in particular this movie. Like, I was a Pee Wee fan, but like, nothing came close to the just everything right that happened with this movie. Like, the second movie was not very good. The show, it's like, it's fun and neat and crazy, but it's like, this movie just does it.
So what parts terrified you as a kid? Like, let's use that as a jumping off point. Like, what were the scenes that particularly like make this a Scarred for Life pick for you? I can think of a couple, but I'm curious what they were for you.
They're probably what you're thinking of, but it's also the package. Like, Pee-wee in general, it's just like, it's fun, but the whole thing is like a little unsettling, and like, kid brain doesn't have the words to explain why this doesn't kind of sit right. You've got this, like, this man pretending to be a child, but is he a child? Like, to the ill-fitting clothes, the haircut is like his everything, which it's funny, but it's a little off-putting. You've got the crazy Danny Elfman score, which just like does everything that a Danny Elfman score is going to do. And then there's a couple particular scenes, which are probably what you're thinking of. The first one I thought of, which I was like afraid of, but also obsessed with as a kid, was the Large Marge scene.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Marge, like, you know, scream at that reveal, but also like would rewind it and watch it again and again and again. And as a little kid, it became this like party trick for adults, to anyone that would listen, that I had this like without any context, to anyone that would listen, I would give this Large Marge monologue to them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it would just, yeah, I would just, you know, oh, and then it's, you know, you're probably at a party, Nick, do the Large Marge thing. And they don't know what it is, but I would very seriously tell them, you know, on this very night, 10 years ago, on the same stretch of road, there was a dense fog. Yeah, I've got it all burned in there in my mind.
Beautiful.
I have a very specific memory of that scene because it terrified me too as a kid. And I would get to I would not only rewind it, but I would hit pause and then do the little skip ahead thing to try to see the change between when she is like a woman and when she is the stop motion type stuff. I would go frame by frame.
It's a real early case of like how you recognize that like they've done something. Like you can't put into words how a movie is made or what, but like how did it get from her face to this, and you want to watch those little bits. Totally did the same thing, you know, one of those I was gonna say VCRs, the beta tape that had like an actual slow-mo play, which it would play through.
I had a frame by frame on my VHS for this, and so you would be able to like click it and go back a frame at a time, and I definitely did that.
So there's definitely the Large Marge scene is like the grail of the movie, like this
of course,
you know, that's but then the movie's got a couple really terrifying nightmare sequences where it's like, you know, Pee-wee's bike has he's lost it, and he has a couple nightmares about what's happening to the bike, and it's got you know, and this is again, the Danny Elfman music does a lot of heavy lifting, like he's got this score specifically for these nightmares that's telling you that's happening. And so the first one, it's, you know, I think the bike's in hell and the devil's like burning his bike. And it's like, you know, the music makes it kind of scary, but it's like, it's a little scary, but it's like accessible. The second nightmare, Pee-wee dreams that these like clowns have taken his bike and they're going to come and they're going to do surgery on it.
Yes.
So, you know, clowns are terrifying, as we all know. We've got the music, we've already seen a nightmare, and it's like, and there's all these cuts to Pee-wee where we're not just seeing the surgery. We've got like, he is selling the hell out of every reaction of like what they're doing to his bike. And these clowns go and they bring it to this doctor as this music plays and they're chopping up the bike. And then one doctor, he's wearing a mask and he rips down his mask and he's got this like horrific clown. He's not a full clown. He's a man. And he's got this like Joker ripped face clown makeup on. And it's horrifying. It's like a legit nightmare fuel. And no matter how many times you see the movie, the thing with these nightmares is like the movie, it does a lot of stuff. He goes on said big adventure, but you know, you don't really know when those nightmares are coming, since they're like this reoccurring thing. So it's like, it's fine. He had this adventure. He ran into this character, but then he's knocked out and he goes to sleep. And then we hear that music come up and we're like, oh shit, no, we're getting back into these nightmares. So like, it's a fun movie, but it's like, it keeps you on edge on like where the nightmares are going to come later on throughout.
I mean, it's like a fever dream in and of itself. And then you have these fever dream nightmares in the middle of it. And it's just like, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. So again, I had not seen this movie since I was a kid. I used to watch this movie a whole lot, but a lot of times when I did that and we would go revisit something for the podcast, I would remember things as I was watching it. And I'll be perfectly honest, aside from the opening bit, up to, I think, the biker bar, which, by the way, has a cameo from Elvira herself. Cassandra Peterson is as the mama at that like grabs him and is basically gonna, who knows, do what to him. But like, that is all I remember from this movie. And so like the last half of it, I'm like, did I just watch the first half of this movie? Because I had no recollection of anything that would follow after that. Nothing. But I did have this weird, like, do you know how, like, the idea of food or smell or taste can, like, bring you back to being a kid? Well, this movie made me remember that as a kid, I would sit there with a Pez dispenser and just eat Pez. So I, like, for some reason, this movie and Pez is like an unlocked memory of, I was sitting here and it's like, oh my God, I remember seeing this part and eating Pez. Like, that is what I remember about this film. And it's such a weird memory to have unlocked watching this last night.
That's beautiful. I love the comparison to food and unlocking memory, that it's going reverse. You're tasting Pez as you're watching.
Yeah. And I haven't had Pez since I was a kid, and I could taste that artificial fruit flavor like wild as I was watching this movie. It was like, it's so weird. This movie is weird.
This movie is weird.
It is.
So you did mention that you were curious about someone that seeing this with blind eyes, and we luckily have one of those people sitting in this Zoom room with us. What did you think about this, Mary Beth? Not to put you on the spot.
Pee-wee Herman.
Did you watch any Pee-wee, or is this like the, this is the introduction?
So, it's like, I knew what Pee-wee Herman was. I was scared of Pee-wee Herman. I didn't like the couch, like the talking couch freaked me out. I didn't like his voice. Just like everything about Pee-wee Herman made me deeply uncomfortable. There was something about him that I just did not trust. Pee-wee Herman just like got my hackles up.
This is all very logical too. This is coming back to that pitching this. I don't know how it went, because like everybody was just hypnotized in something where we should have all felt exactly the way you're talking about it. Because I can't say why I don't feel that way, but it makes so much sense.
It's just, it made me so deeply uncomfortable. And as I was watching it today, I was just like, you know why I didn't like this? Because I did not, and this is going to sound like I hate fun and that I was like had a terrible childhood, so like this is going to make everyone laugh, I could not stand anything with man children like this. I could not handle watching anything with an adult man failing upward and getting like through life without having any sense. And I didn't like get that as a kid. But as I was watching this, and then I was texting my family, because like my mom my mom never showed me Pee-wee Herman, but would always laugh like Pee-wee Herman. So I think it kind of freaked her out too. I think she was like, I don't need my kid acting like this.
She was protecting you.
She was protecting me. But my Mimi, my grandma, was like, I can't stand when adults act like children. And I was like, huh, it all makes sense. I was raised as a very serious child, but could not suffer man children. And it's really benefited me for the long run, though, in my life, that I will not suffer man children. But there was, I get it. It's silly and kitschy, and I love the aesthetic. It's very Tim Burton. I get it to a degree, but Pee-wee Herman makes me want to tear out my eyeballs.
You got through the whole movie?
I did get through the whole movie, because I want to know. I want to appreciate. I want to understand. I get it. I do get it. I still don't particularly like it.
See, I don't get it now. I get it because I got it, but if I didn't have it then, I'd be like, I don't get it.
Well, I mean, like, it's mostly I just get, like, it was like a bunch of dudes got together, did a bunch of drugs, and they got money and just did whatever the fuck they wanted. And, like, I mean, I guess good for them, but also, like, rude.
Like, what's funny is that when they gave him money to go do this, what I found that he did is he and his co-writers read Sid Field's 1979 book screenplay and wrote a script according to the book's advice. So, quote, it's a 90-minute film. It's a 90-page script. On page 30, I lose my bike. On page 60, I find it. It's literally exactly what they said to do in the book. There should be a MacGuffin kind of thing, something you're looking for. And I was like, okay, my bike. Like, he literally read the book and then just, this is what came out of it. And it's wild to me that this was such a cultural, like, landmark of a film that made a ton of money, spawned the show, cemented Paul Reubens as Pee-wee, where he would only do interviews as Pee-wee. He wanted people to think Pee-wee was a real person. So, like, there, it's so bizarre to me that it all started because of Sid Field.
I don't know. I think there's, like, this came out in that era where there were a lot of movies about, like weird dudes, like Dumb and, I think of, like, Dumb and Dumber and, like,
Ace Ventura in the 90s.
And it's, like, always these dudes who are, like, kind Adam of allowed Sandler's to be absolute morons, and everyone loves them, and, like, they get the girl. And, like, I know that it's supposed to be, like, funny, and it makes me so angry. It makes me furious. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter. But watching this now, and maybe because I just, like, in my 30 years of life have dealt with so many man children, I cannot stand this movie. I'm so sorry.
No, I'm hearing this. I'm thinking this should be a podcast, you dissecting these movies. Because, yeah, it's just the thing. It's like, what if man, but he's a robot and a pet detective, and he talks out his butt.
But, like, I was literally watching this and wrote a note, and I was like, how do they rent? How does this man have this house? How does this man pay his rent? How does anything happen? Like, this is a motif with me where I will just think way too hard about these movies and be like, what's the logic? And it's like, there's no logic. But I also am like, but I have to understand, where does he get the money to have a house like this? And why does he have beef with another giant man child whose bathtub is a pool?
Okay, but Francis's bathtub, that was the other thing that, like, I really remember, because I remember being a kid and being jealous of him having this giant swimming pool bathtub where he had chips and he was playing. And I tried to do that in my bathtub, and it was not the same experience as Francis's. Like, that, I was jealous as fuck of Francis's pool. But what I do want to kind of hone in on is the other thing that I remember watching this is like, oh, this is the movie that teachers absolutely hated. Because I don't know if this was the same for you, Nick, but in school, all of the kids that would watch this movie would do the scotch tape pulling up their nose thing, or they would be like, I know you are, but what am I? I know you are, but what am I? Or like, that's my name, don't wear it out. Like, all of these things that he would say. There was some kid, some guy, some boy in my class that would make a complete ass of himself in class and would annoy the fuck out of teachers. I'm pretty sure this movie pissed off a generation of teachers.
And it wasn't 90 minutes. It was just the kid's identity for however long that went on.
Probably still to this day for some of them.
Oh, I was going to say that kid's long dead, but... Why? Awesome. Why? No, I'm sure he's doing fine. I hope he wrote an apology letter to his teacher.
Oh, man.
Like, it's just, I loved Tim Burton as a kid. I grew up on Tim Burton stuff. So, like, Edward Scissorhands was a huge, like, emotional, like, movie that, like, really got to me as a kid. Nightmare Before Christmas was, like, absolutely. And I know that's Henry Selick and that's the whole thing. But, like, Tim Burton was my shit. So I was actually, like, it was kind of surprising that I hadn't watched this. But I think, again, like, my mom wouldn't let me watch things like, this might have been, like, I'm a little bit younger. Did you guys know what Ed, Edd n Eddy is from Cartoon Network, that cartoon? Did you ever watch that?
I never had cable, so I never watched it, but I am familiar
with
it.
Okay. Have you heard of
it? I haven't seen it, but it's in my head somewhere.
Basically, a cartoon about three friends named Ed, Edd n Eddy who are like little gremlin boys who are terrible. And my mom would never let me watch anything that involved boys being gremlins or like having bad behavior because she didn't want us to have that behavior. So I feel like she didn't show me and my brother some of these movies so we wouldn't be annoying and be what she deemed gremlins. Which sounds like I had a terrible childhood. I really didn't. Like, my mom was pretty...
No, mom's laying a good foundation there. there was always something that was the devil, like you know, Bart Simpson was the devil when the Simpsons came out.
Which, yes, my mom also didn't like Bart Simpson, but that was again because the problem always became that my stepdad and my stepbrother would like latch on to things and say them all the time too. So I think she was worried, I'm projecting, but that my brother would catch on to the Pee-wee laugh and do it all the time. And I don't know if she would have made it if my brother was just doing the Pee-wee laugh.
She had a teacher friend that told about a kid saying, I know you are, but what am I? And I was like, that's it.
And then she said, absolutely the fuck not. I will not be doing this with my children.
You know what? I do think now that we're talking about it, that might be why I don't have a lot of memories about this movie outside of like the big specific things, is because my parents were so annoyed with Pee-wee Herman. I remember when we rented this on a VHS, it would have been, I guess 86 probably is when I saw it, 86 or 87. So I would have been like 6 or 7 when I first saw it. And like my parents hated Pee-wee Herman. And I do remember watching the show a couple times and also being really annoyed with the show. I loved the movie from what I remember, but the show with the couch and him and his laugh and everything just wasn't for me or my parents, I think.
Kind of watch it because it's like it's familiar and it's on, but it's this, the movie really had sort of a lightning in a bottle thing. I think there's a lot of hungry people involved, like the stars got this ridiculous thing that somebody gave him millions of dollars to do this thing, and he takes that shot, and Tim Burton just coming out the gate doing the thing that we miss him doing so well.
Is this Tim Burton's first movie?
It's his first movie.
This is his first feature.
And it's also Danny Elfman's first like feature film.
I don't think I realized that. I knew it was early, but I don't think I realized it was the first.
According to what I saw online, I guess Paul Rubens was a fan of Oingo Boingo, which Danny Elfman was part of, and so introduced him to Tim Burton, and now they, you know, are match made in heaven for a very long time.
Wait, what the fuck? We have Pee-wee Herman to thank for that?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I'll give him that. I'll give him that.
It'd be weirder if he wasn't an Oingo Boingo fan.
Right?
Yeah, you're right. It would be weirder if he wasn't an Oingo Boingo fan. Just like Paul Rubens, can we talk about Paul Rubens just like as a man? And RIP to Paul Rubens. He just passed away so recently, which is very sad. I know how many people, and it's very funny because people love this fucking movie, I feel like. Like when he passed away, which was so sad, everyone was like, Pee-wee Herman. I'm like, I don't fucking get it. I don't understand, but that's fine. What an interesting guy with his life basically just being a man child. It's like very Adam Sandler, but with a nicer suit and more blush on his cheeks. It's very interesting, him as a person, as an actor.
I want to say tragic, because I think, you know, I think he loved Pee-wee, but it's you know, Adam Sandler, from what I get, I'm just talking like I know Adam Sandler and what makes him tick, but from what I gather is like the man child he plays in a lot of movies is kind of like that's a version of him where he just gets to vacation and goof around with his buddies and live like a good life that way, where I don't think he has any qualms about those being the movies he does. Paul Rubin, he got to break out of it to a degree, but I think it's something where he created this thing and it's an Urkel effect, but bigger, where you can't break it. His, you know, I think in a weird way that his little theater arrest was like a great thing for him to do, to sever off, which as kids, that's like, there's no fact of the internet or what it is. It's like the crime you think he committed was horrific versus what actually happened. But it did let him put to rest that character a bit, you know, hurting the career and the gajillions of dollars it brought in. But I'm sure the whole thing was a little tired by then, and then got to go and do like never huge, but some interesting character work, and then even some stuff where as a kid you're like, wait, that was Pee-wee in this thing.
Everything goes back to 30 Rock for me, and one of my favorite episodes of 30 Rock is actually where he guest starred as one of the as a prince from Habsburg, and Habsburg is a real place that had like a descendant line that were all inbred because they wanted to keep their line pure. And so he plays this character that is like supposed to be 24 or 25. And of course, as Pee-wee Herman, and this is like in 2013-ish time frame. And so it's like, and that was a role that Tina Fey wrote just for him. And so seeing that as an adult and laughing my ass off it at his character, and then realizing that he has comedic chops. It's just that he was pigeonholed to do Pee-wee for such a long time that I believe his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame is actually Pee-wee. It's not Paul Rubens. So like the fact that that has like informed his entire career up until a specific point, it is. I'm curious. Like it's impossible to know now, but I'm like, I wonder what that was like for him, honestly, because you get a lot of money, but then you are Pee-wee and you're Pee-wee to everyone. And so when you are found in an adult theater, it becomes a huge issue for you.
Yeah. I also like, I had actually just like realized that I think my mom also didn't show me Pee-wee Herman because I was born.
Born after it.
I was born after it. So like,
yeah, I was 91.
Also show. I forgot that. I also wasn't really shown Pee-wee because when I was old enough to watch it, like he'd already kind of had a reputation of being a creep. So it like wasn't as prevalent for me because his reputation had already kind of been messed up. But I guess for me, in my head, it's like, it is really wild. And like, to a point, like, what is that like that it defined his career? But at the same time, like, he was the guy who kind of made it his career at the same time. Like I know that, you know, he didn't mean for it to get as crazy, but like sometimes when guys like this make these characters, I'm always curious about like them as people. And like, what does that say about you at the same time about like this kind of man child character? It's always just interesting. Not saying that he was a bad person. I'm just curious, what trauma did he suffer to make him want to be a little boy forever? Is really what I'm asking here.
I honestly think, because like initially when he was doing that HBO show, it was like a nostalgia thing where like he grew up with the 50s, like Captain Kangaroo, I think, or like Howdy Doody, or like all of those like kid shows that had adults, but they were like four kids, was something that he grew up on. And so like that initial HBO show, and to a lesser extent his primetime ABC, I can't remember what channel it was, but like broadcast channel show, was like this nostalgia of bringing back, again, because it was the 80s, and 80s was in love with the 50s. It was a bunch of like recreating those shows that he grew up on. And so I think for him, that is what initially probably started it, based on everything I've seen. And then it's just because you make a ton of money, you make your career, you know, it's kind of get stuck in it.
Good point.
Yeah. But I think he came to terms with what it was, because he did, you know, there was a crash after the incident. He was kind of gone for a while, and then he was doing some character work, and then it became like pretty respectable. And then much later, he kind of brought Pee-wee, you know, you're talking about feeding into nostalgia. He got to do that again, but with the character itself, but in something where it's like everybody's in on it, that you're not just always Pee-wee. So brought it back with some stuff. Well, also, he did a little bit of film and TV as, you know, not as Pee-wee. So, and I'm sure he was paid handsomely for it as well. So I think it's a good cycle of life for Pee-wee.
I mean, again, I can see the appeal for kids. It is very like candy coated, wild chaos, nuts. Again, I get it.
I gotta know free Pee-wee. I don't know where Pee-wee ranks. Who's your number one most hated like man child character?
Who is my number one most hated man child character?
I'm having deja vu, Mary Beth, because I'm pretty sure we've talked about man children on this podcast before at some point, because I like what you're talking about, like, brought me back to deja vu about it, but I can't remember what it was about.
Talk about man children a lot. So like, it's like, I'm trying to think, it's like all the Adam Sandler movies are big ones that like piss me off. Like Happy Gilmore and like, what's the other one? Billy Madison. Those ones really bother me. Dumb and Dumber really pissed me off. Ace Ventura, like the Jim Carrey movies. And like, I thought Jim Carrey was so funny, and I think that helped, but it always got on my nerves. And like Jack Black also kind of played a lot of those guys, like in Shallow Hal and those kinds of movies. And I think it was really frustrating to see a lot of these schlubby dudes that are like, again, failing upward, like get all the attention. Is just kind of infuriating.
I've got a couple like anti this character movies that I'm like, you gotta check this
okay,
out. You
haven't tell seen. Me. Tell me.
Okay. So have you ever seen the movie Zero Charisma?
No, I have not.
It's like, okay, yeah. So it's probably about 10 years ago. It's relatively low budget indie. And it's about this guy who's like, he's like the big boss nerd of like a D&D circle. D&D. And like just that type of like man-child character. But he's a total piece of shit. And the movie just embraces that and shows it. It's like he sees himself in some other lens than what like the world is. And it's really, really good at sort of just look at this type of character. And then another one that I would recommend even higher if you haven't seen it is, have you seen Red Rocket?
No, but I really want to. I really want to.
Yes.
It's, oh my God.
That's a good dissection of that trope.
Yeah, I would say it's an even better dissection, and I'm not even going to get into it. Just watch it when you get a chance. And yeah, it's struck a hell of a chord with me. Loved this movie. And if you want to see this character fail upwards, but then eat some shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool.
The last bit of like nostalgia that this movie awakened in me, I'm looking back at my notes. And the other one is when Pee-wee gets the Mr. T cereal, because branded cereal in the 80s was so big, like pop culture branding. The Super Mario, and then there was like a Nintendo cereal that was like cut in half.
It was
a half box, and one of it was
cereals in one.
Yeah, it was Zelda, Legend of Zelda on one side and Super Mario Brothers on the other. There was the Mr. T cereal, there was Star Wars cereal. There was like anything that like was remotely kiddish, they would plop it on a cereal and basically resell Captain Crunch's Mr. T.
Yeah,
like it's just
they were definitely Captain Crunch / Corn Pops. Mm-hmm. And then part of me wants to try these cereals, and then which like a reprint of it. I don't want 30-year-old cereal. But I also, well, you know, I might.
They have so much preservatives in them, and they probably are okay.
They probably would survive. There's a Pac-Man cereal, which I think was the same thing, but then also with some Lucky Charms marshmallows.
Little ghosties.
Wayne Gretzky had a cereal. Everybody had a cereal.
Everyone had a cereal in the '80s.
Mr. T is another like what a thing. Like it's not Pee-wee, but a whole just other a career of this character. But I think the line was blurred of like Mr. T the character and Mr. T the man.
That I don't envy anyone like Pee Wee Herman, Paul Rubin, and Mr. T, like having that kind of become you, like that's got to be so weird and difficult to like exist. You know what I mean? Like that, you make a lot of money, but at the same time, like that has got to be exhausting.
Pity the fool that has to have that. I'm sorry.
Wow, I walked.
I know.
That was amazing.
Insert Pee Wee laugh.
That's nothing.
How was that, Mary Beth? Nailed it.
Incredible note. Is there anything else we want to hit on with Pee Wee's Big Adventure before we wrap up and give us a rating out of 5?
There is one thing I watching this now as a queer man in his 40s, some of the queer subtext in this was surprising to me, with like his relationship with the crook that steals the car at one point, where the guy calls him babe at one point, and then also uses the same exact line for Pee-wee that Pee-wee had used on Dottie when Dottie was trying to hit on him, and he's like, I'm a loner, I'm a rebel, and that's the same line that he does. And so like the fact that we have this one character who is Dottie, who by the way is Rugrats's voice actress, like she was the voice actress of I think it was Rugrats. I might be making that all up, but she's done like voice work. She was the voice of Babe and Babe Pig in the City. She was Buttercup from the Powerpuff Girls. I'm trying to think, but like the fact that we have that where she is so obviously in love with Pee-wee, which is kind of weird because she's an adult and he's playing a kid, like it's very weird. And then we have the same thing.
Yeah. Or is he just, I thought he was playing like just a strange adult man who like had something wrong with him. Is he actually a child? Does anyone have an answer for me?
I thought so.
I think that's part of the fascination of Pee-wee, is it's the first of these things to be like, he's not man or child. He's Pee-wee.
Exactly. But he gets in the car with the crook, and the crook is like calling him babe and then uses those lines. And there, I don't know, every single time he is confronted with a woman, he like is like, oh, I gotta stay away. And at one point you could look at it as like childhood innocence, but then on the other side it's like there's something there that like as an adult now that I'm watching, I'm like, huh, okay,
give me gay Pee-wee. Was Paul Reuben gay?
Don't know.
Okay.
I mean, he got in trouble for a bunch of queer erotica that he had in like the 2000s, some of which had underaged kids in it. So I don't know. Like he dated a lot of women, but of course, if you were closeted in that time frame, that's what you did.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I wonder if he didn't. I don't know. I don't want to speculate about, especially if he has passed away, but it's just like, I wonder there has felt any pressure about like his sexual identity and being Pee-wee too, but who the fuck knows, but interesting. Huh?
Yeah.
Interesting. On that depressing note, woo! Do you want to give us our rating out of 5?
Sounds good.
Sorry, Paul Reuben. All right, Terry, you're up first. How many? I know you are, but what am I? Out of 5, do you give Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
I mean, I could be really annoying and just say it the amount of times that I rate it.
I will kick your ass through the computer.
You know, this is a 3 for me. I think as a kid, it would have been much higher. As an adult, I find his character very annoying, but I think that there is like so much inventiveness in this, and I think it is such a surreal trip that I am surprised became such a cultural moment in the 80s. The fact that we get like this fantastic meta ending where like he is racing through the Warner Brothers lot, he gets his bike back by basically selling his life story and then getting turned into a movie played by James Brolin. Is that what his name was? And Morgan Fairchild as Dottie. Like the fact that that is how this ends is wild to me. And I started watching this thinking, oh my gosh, is this where Michael Myers got his idea for Austin Powers 3, where like there's the Austin Powers movie that Steven Spielberg is directing? Like, I'm like, I see this and I'm thinking there's some really smart stuff in here, in amongst it being such a surreal trip for kids, that it's 3 for me. Cause it is not something that I will go revisit, but like there's something there that I think is wild and quintessentially 80s. So that's for me. What about you, Mary Beth? This is going to probably be lower.
All right. I very much appreciate how much everyone loves Pee-wee Herman. I like the kitsch of it all. I think I would love to see a John Waters version of Pee-wee. I also feel like John Waters loves Pee-wee Herman. I don't know if I actually read that somewhere or if I just get the vibe that this would be a John Waters vibe. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I would love to see John Waters make a super perverted, weird Pee-wee Herman movie. So badly do I desire to see a perverted Pee-wee Herman movie, which I don't know what that says about me as a person. It's a two for me. I appreciate the aesthetic and what it is, and some of the jokes made me laugh. Like I remember the Alamo, and everyone cheers. Like okay, come, like it's a classic. I will laugh at that. It's so ridiculous, but it's funny. And when he says I'm in Texas, and he starts singing, and they all start singing back, like I will give it credit. There's some really clever stuff going on here, but Pee-wee Herman as a character makes my skin crawl. It's a two. Nick, you have the final word. How many, I know you are, but what am I, is do you give?
I'm gonna counter with a solid four. It's not a five because fives are fives, but you know, we're still talking about this movie, this thing that should have been a one and done character that nobody remembers, or it's like, oh, that was, it's still has life, and just like all the magic that we talked about on who was involved, some firsts from some like real heavy hitters in the industry, and just the hunger and desire to go weird, and that weird to be a hit. Like it's fine to dig up weird and be like, oh, this is a weird little movie, but this movie was massive and spawned so much, and I think it's for a reason. I think it's a solid four for me.
Hell yeah. Yeah, cool.
Well, thank you so much, Nick, for joining us to talk about Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Where can our listeners find you online, and what do you have to share that you can talk about? The floor is yours.
If you want to find me online, I'm unfortunately on Twitter for some reason. I think they call it X now, but I refuse to do so. Yeah, I'm just gonna like stay on that ship until it sinks or just becomes worse. I'm on Twitter talking about nonsense, probably talking about Pee-wee and this podcast. If you're into horror and westerns and love this stuff together and dad lit, then check out Skinning the Coyote. I promise you're in for a good time.
Can confirm. If you like bloody, scary monsters, it's a good time. But listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. Where do you fall on the side of loving or being terrified of Pee-wee Herman? You can
sometimes
let us know.
In the same thought.
You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on Twitter and or other social media platforms. On Twitter, I am at MB McAndrews, and I think I'm also that on Blue Sky.
You are. And I am I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere, Blue Sky, Twitter. If Twitter is still here by the time this comes out, who knows?
And make sure to follow the podcast on all the socials. We are at Scarred Podcast on Twitter. We are at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram and on Blue Sky.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
We sure fucking do. Thank you to Eric Power for artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there. Most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.